Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Paul Prinsloo in this episode. Paul is Professor of Business Management with the University of South Africa, UNISA. Paul has a broad perspective in distance and online education at scale, giving him a well-grounded and innovative perspective. Paul and I talked via Skype. Well, I'm joined now by Professor Paul Prinsloo from the College of Economic and Management Sciences at the University of South Africa. Paul is a specialist in the areas of open and distance learning, and more specifically in learning analytics. Paul, it's great to be talking with you.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for the invitation.
Paul, can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
I started at the University of South Africa in a regional office quite to the north of the country in an administrative role. It was a second career for me. I started afresh, and that gave me a very specific experience of distance education. I'm getting back to open distance learning a bit later, but that at that stage, our institution was still very distance education. Students studied from printed materials. I was appointed also as a tutor and met with students on Saturdays in two very separate and very distant locations to the north of the country. And that gave me a very specific understanding and experience of distance education from a more rural setting and from an administrative role. And I think that has become a leitmotif in my work and my understanding of distance education as a system. As an administrative officer, we were looked down on by academics. We were sort of the pen pushers. While from our side, we experience students and we experience their frustrations. And so very early in my career at UNISA, I became aware of the tensions between the administrative or the support staff and then the academic staff. And at that stage, I was support and administrative. So I was on the receiving end of their distrust and just not being good enough, according to the academics. So that was 1995. So about 7 years, I played a role in student advising, student support, and then also as a tutor. Then in 2002, I accepted the position as instructional designer, or in the context of UNISA, we were called learning developers, which was a professional role. So I moved from an administrative role to a professional role and working with academics. And that brought me into contact with designing learning experiences. In the beginning, still very printed materials, but increasingly the use of multimedia in their courses and then online. And I had to work with academics as a learning designer or instructional designer. And that gave me a sense of the limitations of designing learning in text format and the difficulties we had to cross the digital divide and the epistemological divide between our learners and our academics and what role design could play. But that also led me to my first research. Just before I left my role as administrative officer, I published my first article based on student experiences. And this morning when I prepared for the interview, I looked back and the title was Anonymous Learners. And at that stage, I felt that UNISA as an institution, we don't really know our learners and their journeys. And that has become a leitmotif in my research and in my being a distance education educator, is trying to understand what our students go through. So as an instructional designer, I was trying to bridge a number of gaps. Then in 2009 to 2011, I was responsible for mapping the institution and running about 8 institutional teams on redefining UNISA as from a distance education to an open distance learning institution, which was very interesting. It gave me a very high perspective of what is going on at UNISA. And that really shaped my understanding of UNISA as a very complex system in the context of the global south. In 2007, I received my first fellowship from the Open University, where I met Sharon Slade. And so we've been collaborating now for 12 years. So that's where our relationship started. And the other defining moment in my short career was then in 2011, I wrote a conceptual paper with a very dear colleague of mine, George Sabosky, who's late, about the social critical understanding of student success. So, yeah, and then the last major move in my career was in 2013 when I became a research professor in business education. What the magic of all of this was that I really think my role as administrative officer in a very rural setting at UNISA, and then moving to instructional design, and then moving into academia as research professor, really gave me a very profound, for me at least, understanding of how complex business education is. So these experiences shaped my research.
Excellent. It's really exciting or interesting to hear that you started instructional design in the 2000s. There was a lot of literature that came out around about that time. Who were some of the major influences on your work then, Paul?
I think in the UNISA context, we were more European than American. In America, we were very aware that they were using the term instructional design, while in South Africa, we were more leaning towards the European discourses of learning design. Mm. And there, the work of Ronja Knoll and Jenny Salmon, especially with online learning and the scaffolding, that was very seminal for our understanding. And at that stage, we had very close links with the University of Leicester, where Jenny Salmon and later Ronja Knoll were heading their departments. So that shaped our understanding of instructional design.
Wonderful. So, Paul, you've got a very extensive list of publications next to your name, no doubt inspired by your learning design activity and more recently, of course, by your work as a professor in distance education. Can you tell us about some of the ideas and themes that your work has provided, particularly those you sense are still pertinent today?
So that first article with the title Anonymous Learners were really, for me, the moment where I started to reflect on student journeys in distributed learning contexts. So that was very seminal. Then what was interesting that in 2004, as instructional designer, I published from my interactions with academics. So as instructional designer or learning designer, I worked with academics in the field of the economic and management sciences, economics, accounting, statistics. And I co-published with them as we redesigned their courses. So my early articles were very much focused on understanding why are some students in the teaching of accounting, for example, successful or not, or in the teaching of economics. Now, these courses in the context of UNISA are very large courses. In Economics 101, we have 14,000, that is 14,000, students per 12-week semester. So these were massive courses before the massive open online courses. How do you teach that amount of students distributed across South Africa and Africa, making use of printed study materials over the course of 12 weeks with a postal system that was collapsing? So students had to send back assignments. It was the early days of online learning in South Africa. So most of my articles since 2004 were based from my work with academics. And that gave me my first experiences of co-authoring and collaborating, which for me is sort of one of the signatures of my research. I love to collaborate. In my context, it's often seen as when I co-publish with someone, it only counts as half an output for some reason. For me, collaborating with another author is often more work. So my early research up to 2011 was very much discipline-based, raising awareness of the risk of failure in first-year accounting students, in economics, and so that was very exciting. The next sort of seminal moment in my research career and my publications were the article I referred to in 2011 with George Sabosky, where we wrote or we developed a conceptual understanding of student success in an open distance learning environment in the global south. Yeah. And our suspicion at that stage was that the early models of Tinto and Spady and most of the work of student success and understanding student success came from the global north. And we took a social critical approach and we developed this model. And I still think it shaped my understanding. What was also seminal in that period, that was my first publication with Sharon Slade and then Fenella Galpin, flowing from our collaboration. Mm. And in 2013, through serendipitous events, Sharon invited me to think with her on learning analytics and the ethics in learning analytics. Now, learning analytics emerged in 2011, so this was very early days. And when Sharon said, let's move into this field and think specifically about the ethics, we jumped at the opportunity, and that has become, I think, our signature paper. In 2013, we published Learning Analytics, Ethical Issues and Dilemmas. And that is our most cited work. And when I go back, and I often go back to that, that still informs my thinking. I don't know what happened with that article, Mark, but we were at the right moment, at the right time, and we were able to map some serious concerns that I think in some way shaped the field ever since. The rest increasingly moved me into the full field of learning analytics, into issues surrounding the collection, the analysis, and the use of student data, whether it's privacy, whether it's how we use the data. What was also emerging during that time was also a wonderful collaboration with a fellow colleague of mine about postgraduate supervision. So as I moved into a more academic role, I was required to supervise postgraduate students. And that became for me another area of praxis of reflecting on what I'm doing. If I now look back on my publications on the last 5 years, learning analytics and the use of data is dominating, but then there's this issue of postgraduate supervisor identity and the issues around that. So that's in short my publications and what informed them and what shaped them.
Mm. It sounds like a wonderfully opportunistic approach to research. So you're making the most of opportunities as they arise, but you're also researching to inform your own practice.
Yeah, I think I couldn't do it less because I was sort of kind of finding my way into instructional design. I read a lot. I think I started very early when I arrived in my new role. I realized I know nothing about the field. I don't know why I was appointed. and I just felt like an imposter, and I started reading ferociously into the field, and that informed my practice and raised more questions. And I did research, so it became sort of a very reflective practice ever since.
So, Paul, what can you tell us about how the move to online has shaped your practice? Because I'd imagine having started back then in the early 2000s, there would have been a lot more emphasis on print. I'm certain these days there's probably a lot more emphasis in the online environment for student learning. What can you tell us about your own transition across those two different types of offering?
UNISA, with 350,000 students, each of our almost 4,000 courses have an online presence. But what we haven't solved yet, for a number of reasons which I will go back to now, is what does effective and appropriate learning online looks like when most of our students don't have access to networked environments because of the cost of data or not just being part of a network. How do you provide online learning to students that may have access to a networked environment once a week? That comes at a huge cost to them when they have to download materials or download videos or watch online. And to be quite frank with you, I don't think we've solved that. I think my sense of the field is that we will be in a blended environment where print or printed materials will still continue to be for a very long time still the baseline for teaching at UNISA. Mm. With, as we move increasingly online, it will be supplemented and supported by online teaching events or an online presence. At UNISA, we have only seven fully online undergraduate modules, one in each of our colleges. But there, the issue of online learning has a very specific characteristic. Our problem here is, what does an online course look like very interactive over a 12-week semester with 14,000 students enrolled in that course. What does interactivity look like? How scalable is it to require of learners and the tutor to sort of build and construct knowledge when not all of them are online once a week, at least, where you sit with tutor-student ratios of 1 to 100. Can you imagine if we had to take as a guideline appoint one tutor for every 20 students? Can you imagine how many tutors we have to appoint for 14,000 students? And that brings me to a very interesting dilemma, the Iron Triangle, that early work by Daniel and Kanwa. In this Iron Triangle of balancing cost, quality, access, so at UNISA, we have 350,000 students that we allow into the system and into online environments. We would love to provide them with a 1-to-20 ratio with lectures or tutors, but that comes at a huge cost, which they or we cannot afford. So we compromise there in order to keep the cost low, but what happens to quality then? So what is good enough for them, what is affordable for us? So that is, in my perspective, in specifically in the South African environment, a crucial issue to continue grappling with the compromises we make in making the online learning environment accessible for the maximum amount of students without lowering quality. And of course, the brutality of the compromises we sometimes must make. The two other things that I think that shapes the online environment and our teaching online is, from an instructional design perspective, when we start to work with lectures, we design for both online and print, which is a dangerous situation because a printed learning experience looks very, very different from an online experience. So again, there it's a compromise of, in the printed guide, to refer to the online environment, but our printed materials stand for at least 3-4 years to make that cost effective. So we haven't solved that quite successfully yet, how to balance what we print that can last for 3 years or 4 years just to make it cost effective, and to continuously adapt the material and the learning in an online environment. The second aspect that is very crucial for us is the student support students need when they're entering this online environment. For most of our students, they join these online environments in their second or third language, that is English. All our materials are printed in English. Their ability and their competence to communicate effectively in an academic setting in English, there's a number of issues. And then just how do you scale support to students that feel excluded from the dominant epistemologies in that discourse or in that environment, and then just to cope with this level of communication. So that's a very specific issue. I cannot see us going fully online with no printed materials for most of our courses for quite some time to come.
So Paul, do you think students are disadvantaged in any way if they cannot access the online resources or the online activities?
Coming from apartheid and colonialism, social justice is very central to our vision and mission. We don't want to exclude anyone. And I think that is a major concern. While I think the world of work will be digital and will be online, and we must prepare our students to, by the time they graduate, that they can be critical digital citizens. So that's where we want them to exit. But then just the reality of the cost of data and the cost to, or the access to networks. Often they share devices. They share devices with family members and other students. So that's a major issue that we don't want to exclude students. A number of years ago, UNISA wanted to move very strongly into fully online. But then there is the issue of we will exclude students and we're supposed to be open. So there is a cost of open, to open, Mark, and we face that on a daily basis. How are you open and not exclude people from the learning experience and from the support they need?
Are there competitors starting in the South African area who are hitting the online market fairly hard, or is UNISA seen as the incumbent there that could move in as it wants to?
I think we see a number of private providers, private higher education and private pre-higher education institutions moving into the field, but I think they face the same issues that we face with regard to cost, affordability, and not excluding anyone. But there is a drive. I don't think they are competition yet. The other interesting thing is, as most South African higher education institutions, the other 23, UNISA always had we were the only distance education provider in the South African context, and that changed now since 3 years ago. So the other universities can now go into distance education, and they do. They increasingly offer blended or fully online offerings. But the need for access to higher education in South Africa is so big, Mark, that we need all the help we can get.
Paula, it's now early 2019. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time?
As a reviewer to articles, I think if I have to review yet another article about comparing online learning with face-to-face experience, I will just collapse. We need to ban comparisons between face-to-face experiences and online learning experiences. For me, we just have to move beyond that. Each in its own right plays a role and can be effective under certain conditions. I would say our question should be, under what conditions, in which disciplinary context, at what point of scalability can online learning be successful? It's not a given that it's always successful in all disciplinary contexts at all scale. I think there's nuances. There's online supported, there's fully digital learning, there's digitally supported. So there's these possibilities that we must utilize in a specific discipline like accounting that will look different in sociology. It will look different if I have 10 students, it will look different if I have 14,000 students. The other thing is the issue of scalability, and I'm getting back to the Iron Triangle, finding the most appropriate, the most ethical balance between cost, quality, access. How many students can we allow into this online learning environment, at what cost to them, at what cost to us, at what quality, what happens there? I don't think we've solved that, and I would love to see some research on under what conditions is this online experience the most effective and the most ethical and appropriate than it can be.
There's a very good mix of ideas there. But of course, quite often I think researchers can be accused of trying to find the right answer or the right approach. But you're quite right. A lot of it is contextual. What works in this discipline may not work in that discipline. What works with these 100 students may not work with those 10,000 students.
Absolutely. I mean, discussion forums and in the learning theory of constructionism or social constructionism, it's sort of seen as the gold standard. But what does that look like when you have 14,000 students in economics 101 studying in a distance education setting in the global south in their third language? So what does a discussion forum in accounting look like, or in chemistry or physics, with their specific use of a specific visual vocabulary? So yes, I think what I've learned in the South African context is specifically context is everything.
Paula, it sort of leads quite nicely into the next question, which is the sorts of research you'd most like to see. What would be the dream article for you to suddenly see published in a journal?
I would love to see us being more critical about our assumptions about the student experience. I still encounter almost on a daily basis, whether from management or from academia, a number of assumptions we make about our students, their student, their epistemologies, their access to technology. So I really want to see research critically engaging with what are our assumptions about the learning experience of students. I would love to see more longitudinal studies of the student experience, of the teaching experience. And I think there's some magic to really map students' learning journey from their first enrollment to the point where they exit the institution 6 years later. What happened in their lives? What happened in the lives of the teachers that taught them? Combined with the student experience that I still think we don't understand, it's still a puzzle for us, despite our obsession with their data, is also the faculty experience. There's increasing micromanagerialism, there's performance criteria, there's this madness of trying to do as much as possible in the days and the weekends time. And I really think it has huge cost to our faculty. So I would love to see more research about the faculty experience, and not in the sense of just blaming management, but to map our experiences. The third thing that I really think we need to see more of is to say, yes, we do have access to increasingly amounts of student data and increasingly nuanced formats of student data that we often take as proxies to their learning and to their lives. And I would like us to see more critical research about our assumptions about the data we have about our students. I would love to see research on our students' perceptions on the data we have of them and whether our proxies and our assumptions are actually correct.
So there's a cry out there almost for a deeper sense of qualitative data. As I suppose at the moment we're just awash in so much quantitative data analytics. But what you're saying is that there's real value in the qualitative stories, the narratives that could arise if only we took the time to get out there and do some good solid research in that area.
I don't say it's easier, but with the amount of digital data and digital footprints we have, it's so much easier to publish a quantitative study on student learning in a semester, while there's almost no time to do a deep qualitative analysis of their learning journey in that same semester. I don't shy away from the quantitative data, but I really think we need the qualitative, we need the small data research.
That sounds exactly like the sort of paper I'd like to wake up and read one day too, actually. Paul, you've mentioned some people already who have influenced you, particularly in the area of learning design. But who are two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning? One whose work or perspective has significantly influenced you and perhaps still influencing you, and also one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
Oh my goodness, you've interviewed so many great people, Mark, and I think the people that I will mention, I do think that you have already interviewed them. In a South African context, it's Laura Tsarnelich from the University of Cape Town. For me, yes. She's a lodestar. She's my compass. She has a profound sense of social justice. She's one of the earliest South African authors that engage with the issues and the nuances of the digital divide and the cost of access. The other one that I find is magical is Maha Bali from Egypt. Those two I consider to be in many ways, also personal ways, very close to my understanding. A person that I don't think you've interviewed yet is Chris Gilliard of the US. He's raising very, very important questions about how networks and online learning often exclude students. So Chris Gilliard, I would really say his research and his understanding of digital networks is profound. And then the other one is Michael Quett. He was at Yale. He just completed his PhD. And I really think he's a voice to watch. He's working on digital colonialism and the colonization of student data and asking very, very critical questions about our assumptions about data and who has access to our student data.
Paul, it's been a real privilege talking with you. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. And of course, I've also enjoyed your scholarship. Thank you very much for joining me as a legend of online learning.
Thanks. I'm not quite sure about the legend, but the conversation was great. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Paul. You can learn more about Paul and link to some of his publications from our website. His Twitter handle is 14princp. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website www.onlinelearninglegends.com to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.